questions about anything? Yeah, so I actually don't have them here because I have them on my cart, but you can pick it up. So we got the big quiz today. I'll hand that out after we start. We'll have another constellation quiz on Monday, then we'll have an exam on Wednesday. So usually there's a opportunity for you to get together as a group and ask me questions, which I usually call a help session, and the idea is to kind of vote on a candidate time. So I can't do it Tuesday, you know, kind of 4-ish because I'm in lab, but the other times are like Monday at 4-ish or Monday at 8-ish or Tuesday at 8-ish. Could actually be Sunday, but my guess is that people don't want to do it on Sunday. Okay, so who's for Monday as opposed to Tuesday? Who's for Tuesday as opposed to Monday? So it's actually exactly equal. Who really wants it in the afternoon, which it could only be on Monday? Yeah, okay, so it's gonna be either Monday or Tuesday. The precise time doesn't matter. If there's a particular time that'll work better for you. So now, voting between those two, who wants it Monday at 8 p.m.-ish? So I get 9. Who's for Tuesday at 8 p.m.-ish? So I get 6. Now I get 7, but still it's not 9. Monday. Any particular time better than any other particular time, earlier, later than 8 p.m.? 8 p.m. is the perfect time? 8:30. You don't want it later.
I can't be here till 8:30, but that's okay.
Is 8:15 a compromise? Not really, huh? 8 then, huh? Well, I forget like I did last time. It'll be 8:05. Yeah. So, you know, I think the help session is great, but I think probably the best way to study for the exam is to actually work the old exam, come up with your own answers, bring it in, let me basically grade it in front of you, talk about the answers. Questions on any of that? And I don't know, while I was waiting, I kind of wrote down you know that the lectures are all online if you want to listen to my beautiful voice for another whatever 7 hours. So those are kind of the titles of the last lectures since the last exam. So conservation laws, sound and light, spectra, atoms and quarks, telescopes, and today telescopes, and maybe we'll start to the sun, and Monday we'll talk more about the sun. Quantum mechanics. Going, gone. Okay, so last time we were talking about telescopes. Why telescopes, what purpose do telescopes serve, and we kind of made this list of possibilities. And I think maybe the most important point is that often what comes to mind first is magnification. And magnification is probably actually the least useful aspect of a telescope. It's really not much use to make a big fuzzy ball bigger and fuzzier. It's pretty easy to do, and I guess that's in some sense another reason that it's not particularly important. We're usually interested in seeing dim objects and seeing them as clearly as we can. So seeing fine details is different from magnification. Magnification is just how big it is. Details are something else. And often we're interested in using telescopes to see things you can't literally see with your eye. Things like radio telescopes are producing pictures that you would see with radio eyes, which obviously our eyes aren't. So we're going to build telescopes out of mirrors and lenses. What are kind of the properties of mirrors and lenses? The aperture, means the same thing as the diameter of the mirror lens, and usually we're interested in the primary or the objective. That's the biggest mirror or lens that's in the device, which is also the thing that the light hits first. The focal length of a mirror lens, and you'll do this yourself in a second, but if you've ever burned ants or something with a lens, you know that you can take an object like the sun, and if you put a piece of paper that it's at the right distance from the lens, you get a focused image. So I'm not looking through the lens, obviously. I'm just moving this piece of paper back and forth until I get as clear an image of the filament as I can possibly get. So this distance, the distance from the lens to the focused image, that's what the focal length is. And then we can take the ratio of the two, the focal length divided by the aperture. That's sometimes called the f-stop or the f-number, and it's usually pronounced f and then exactly what that number is. So on a camera lens, you can usually set the aperture, the f-number, by turning some sort of knob. In this case, f-16 is a relatively small aperture, right? To get a big f-number, you want a small aperture in the denominator. And to get a small f number, you want a big aperture in the denominator. The focal length of the lens is fixed, right? We can put this iris in front of a lens to so-called stop it down. So the aperture, bigger the aperture, the more light you're collecting. Turns out that the focal length has to do with the size of the image. If the image is further and further from the lens, it's going to be bigger and bigger and bigger. And the F number has to do with the image brightness. And again, I hope you'll see these things directly after the big quiz when I put lenses in your hands. So originally, telescopes were often made out of lenses. Galileo's first telescope was made out of lenses. These days, telescopes are usually made out of mirrors, reflectors. So, you know, why the difference? Well, if you have a lens, you have to have two clean surfaces, one at the front and one on the back, whereas with a mirror it just takes one. You have to have no bubbles inside your lens, so that's, you don't care if there are bubbles inside your mirror. Probably the most important reason actually has to do with support. That if you're holding a lens, you have to do it on the thinnest possible part, and if we're talking about ton size lenses, that becomes difficult. Whereas with a mirror, you can hold it from the bottom, and so you can have a better support for it. There's also a technical detail that a lens bends blue light differently from how it bends red light. That's why we are able to make prisms. So the focal point of blue light is actually at a different point than the focal point of red light. So that means that if the blue light is in focus, the red light isn't. And this is called chromatic aberration. And it's obviously not present with a mirror, because for any color of light, the angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection for a mirror. So if we have a reflector, then the issue is, how do we get the light from being in front of the mirror? And we talked about four different ways of doing it. You can do nothing. That's called prime focus. So you would put your head or a piece of film right there inside the barrel of the telescope. Doesn't look like a very good idea. You could bounce the light out the side. That was Newton's idea, so that's called the Newtonian reflector. Or you can drill a hole in the primary mirror and have the light bounce back there. So that's called the Cassegrain focused telescope, and it's these days by far the most common type of telescope, basically for mechanical reasons. Usually we're attaching some weighty device to the telescope, some sort of complicated camera, and the mirror already weighs tons, so it'll be most convenient to attach the weighty device right next to the mirror, as opposed to some off-center, unsymmetrical location to the side. CUDA focus, you can't draw. The idea is to bring the light to a fixed location on the observatory floor. And that would be for devices that are too heavy to be put on the telescope per se. So through a series of mirrors, you bring the light out to a fixed location, so no matter where the telescope is pointed, the light goes to the same spot. So we got vocabulary words. Resolution is the word that goes along with fine details. So technically speaking, resolution is the smallest angle that you can just barely perceive as being different. So if we had, for example, two stars that are close together, as close as they could be together and we could still see them as two objects as opposed to one. That angle would be called the resolution. The thing that most affects fine details that we can see with optical telescopes is that we live under this ocean of air and that the ocean is not steady. It has waves in it. So stars are always being pushed around a little bit by the individual waves that we have to see through. So that's called atmospheric seeing, and it's what limits the resolution that we can see with most optical telescopes, certainly the optical telescopes we have at our observatory. Objective, primary, they mean the same thing. They're the big lens or mirror that the light hits first. So they're the expensive piece of a telescope. The big piece of glass is the objective or the primary. The eyepiece is the little piece that sits next to your eye, right? So in this very junior telescope, the light is first going to hit this moderately big size lens. So this is the objective lens. And there's a much smaller lens here at the end that is the eyepiece. So the eyepiece is where you put your eye, obviously. Field of view, that's how big a piece of the sky you can see when you're looking through your telescope, right? So with the binoculars, we could see about 7 degrees or so as our field of view. And they had a magnification of about 7. What magnification means, it's the ratio of how big things look through the telescope compared to what they look like when you're looking at them with your naked eye. And it turns out that the magnification can be calculated as the focal length of the objective divided by the focal length of the eyepiece. So since you can change your eyepieces pretty easily, you can change the magnification of a telescope pretty easily.
And then, the one thing I don't get from this is if you want to zoom in or something, so that's just making the distance farther and the image bigger?
So, things are kind of more complicated now that we have digital cameras that seem to automatically change instantaneously from being telephoto lenses to being normal lenses. And the first thing I want you to realize is that's not possible. Right? So the size of the image depends on this thing, right? And I have to literally somehow change this piece of glass in order to change where the image is. But you can imagine I could reground this lens so that the image would be way out here and it would be then bigger. Or I could have, again, change this piece of glass and have the image be in focus at this spot. Okay, so how in a digital camera do they regrind these lenses to change where the focus comes together? And of course, they can't literally be regrinding the lenses. That's not how it works. So it works that they have two lenses that are working together. And it turns out that two lenses, by changing the distance between two lenses that are working together, you can effectively change the focal length. But in the old days, if you had a long lens, if you had a telephoto lens on your camera, you had to put it on. And it was literally a lens that just had a longer focal length and therefore had to sit a greater distance from the film. More questions? So you can hear the gears grinding when you take your digital camera and change it from, normal magnification to 4x magnification. It's moving those lenses around to effectively change the focal length, more than one lens. Okay. It might be worth stressing that you should never see on an astronomical image a little cut in that says that this is times 100 or something, because it doesn't fundamentally make sense. The word magnification can't apply to a picture, right? Because I can make that picture bigger or smaller just by bringing it closer to my eye. So if you're talking about an image in a book, what we really care about is, something like a scale factor. 1 degree in the sky is so many inches in this image. So we have to have something that has units like inches per degree, or the inverse of it, degrees per inches, whereas magnification by itself is a unitless number because it's the ratio of two of the same things. Questions on anything? Okay, so big quiz time. I don't know, 15 minutes, something like that. don't know if you believe it, but the purpose for quizzes is not to torture you. The purpose really is to get you better prepared for the exam. And I actually think this quiz is easier than the exam will be. You can, of course, look at the online exams to get a perfectly good idea of the sort of thing they're like. So you want to make sure your names are on these guys and you can throw them over towards the door. There's another no name from the constellation quiz, so if you didn't get back your constellation quiz, yeah, I'll wait till get a pack of them. Yeah, sitting up there. So it's Ben, huh? You can take it with you. Say again? I can if you want. We'll certainly, I don't know if you want to do it now or you want to do it Monday when you have it back in your hands.
Name?
Now it better. Okay, so I got them all? So the spectra is a graph of wavelength. It could be frequency, except the numbers are in meters, so it has to be wavelength. And the Y label, there are lots of possibilities. The one I like the best is the amount of light. So I think that was labeled energy flux online, and I think it might be labeled intensity in the book. Those are all perfectly good names. And the picture looks roughly like this. There's kind of a smooth curve, and there was a spot where there was extra light, and there was a spot where there was too little light. So label the following features. Emission line is where there's extra light emitted. So this is an emission line. Label absorption line. This is where the light is absent. So that must be an absorption line. And the peak, this is the peak. The peak wavelength is whatever wavelength corresponds to the peak. In the production of an emission line, are the electrons moving up or down? So they're giving up energy, so they have to be going down, right? Just like a piece of chalk has to be going down if it's giving up energy. How would the thing change if the electrons ended up at an energy level that was slightly higher? So in the jump we're thinking about, a downward jump, we have light that's produced. What would happen if the N level were slightly higher? Well, that would mean that there'd be a little bit less energy in the jump. And energy is related to frequency and wavelength. The longer wavelength of light would have a little bit less energy. So instead of this peak occurring here, it would move over a little bit to longer wavelengths. How would it happen if more electrons made the absorption leap? So every time an electron absorbs light, there's less of it. So if more of them were doing it, it would mean that there would be even less light at that wavelength. How would it change if the object were cooler? So if the object were cooler, there'd be less light at every wavelength, so the whole curve should lie below the previous curve, and it should be shifted to longer wavelengths. And the absorption lines, they're atomic properties. They don't care about the temperature, so they shouldn't change. So it should be every place below the previous one. Peak moves to longer wavelengths. The absorption lines occur exactly where they were before. Ultraviolet light is short wavelength. I don't really care about exactly where you mark these. The infrared is long wavelength, and between them is going to be visible wavelength. Technically speaking, the visible wavelength is maybe 0.4 to 0.7 micrometers, but it's the order that I actually care about, not the location. So the first telescope is a refracting telescope, and so this is going to be a pretty crude sketch. The aperture is the diameter of the primary, so it's the diameter of the barrel. The first thing the light hits is the objective, so that's the objective, and of course the other one is the eyepiece. And the light needs to come to a focus point someplace in front of the eyepiece. The other telescope is a Newtonian telescope. I won't bother to try and draw it since there's one here. So this is the primary mirror. The diameter of the tube, that's the aperture. The focal length of the objective is the distance that it takes to get to focus light. And obviously the stars, in this case, are over here, but the drawing is more like that. So the stars would be over there in the online version of it. So electron orbits. The ground state is the closest orbit. The excited state is any other orbit, so currently the electron is in an excited state. Sketch how the electron would move if it absorbed a photon. So if it's gained energy, it should be moving out. If it's emitting energy, it should be moving in. The protons and neutrons are in the nucleus, which is the thing in the center. The electrons are the things in the orbits, and the quarks would be inside the protons and neutrons. No actual colors associated with protons and neutrons. Questions? So you're all going to get 100% when the same, more or less same questions are on the exam, I hope. I hope. Any miscellaneous questions? Okay, so let's... No, it's not all over for today. Lots more for today. I would have put more questions on the quiz if it was over today. So let's take, you know, another view of one of these kind of cheesy animations. This one is supposed to remind you about what resolution means. So remember, resolution is the smallest angle where you can see two things as being two separate things as opposed to one big blob. And one situation that's common is to look at oncoming car lights, right? You know there are two of them unless it's a motorcycle, but when the object is distant, it really looks pretty much like one. But as it approaches, eventually we reach the point, you know, right about there, where we see it as two objects as opposed to just one. So where we can just barely resolve that there are two dots as opposed to one, that the angle between that, those two, that's what we mean by resolution. Replay, yeah, boy. It's too good to miss. We're in someplace around there, that's where we have the visible resolution. Okay, so here's kind of another story of resolution. I tried to show you this with an overhead, but I think it works better this way. So what we see is various sizes of H's with various amounts of blurring. So blurring has to do with resolution. And you can see that if the H is big enough, even in the most blurred case, I can distinguish that it's an H. But in kind of intermediate cases, no, I would be hard put to say that that or that is in fact an H. And the main point of this is that magnification doesn't help, right? If I just blow up these fuzzy images, you know, I can't tell any more than I could before. So it's resolution, it's the amount of blurriness that we care about, not not actually the magnification per se. Okay, so we got some pictures of some telescopes here. It's got similar pictures in your book. So this is the biggest refracting telescope that was ever made. It's in Wisconsin, shores of Lake Geneva, the Yerkes Observatory. It was run by the University of Chicago. And the aperture, the diameter of this barrel is about a meter. So here's a more modern telescope. The dome is, as you can see, as you know from the observatory, is totally optional. Here's the inside of a big telescope. This is actually Mount Palomar. So this is where the mirror is. And this is a cage it's usually used in Cassegrain focus. So this is a cage that would protect people from material that has fallen off from its attachment point at the back of the mirror. And of course, the top of the telescope is someplace up there. We talked about radio telescopes. And this is the big radio telescope that I was talking about, Arecibo, Puerto Rico. And they just took a valley and lined it with radio reflectors, then suspended the collector in front of it. It's not very aimable, but it's about as big as you could possibly make a radio telescope. And here's kind of the alternative, which we want to talk more about. This is, they're going to rename this. They're in the process of renaming this, but it's currently called the Very Large Array. And you can see it's just a bunch of individual radio antennas that can be all aimed at the same object. And this game is called a radio interferometer. And as I say, that's probably the kind of next thing to talk about. Questions?
How much do those cost?
I have not the foggiest idea. If I made up a number, it would be totally made up. Yeah, I'm sure it's multiple millions of dollars. Probably less than $100 million. So, I don't know, let's say $10 million each or something like that. Say again?
More money than we'll ever have.
Well, collectively you have that money, right, as the United States government. That's who paid for it. Incidentally, if you're an individual rich person, like a Microsoft billionaire, then you can also afford one of these. So Allen famously paid for what's called the Allen Array, which is a big array of radio telescopes that actually ran out of money about a month ago, and then they got it refunded. So it's back in business. More questions? Yeah, so that's the topic we want to talk about, interferometers. That's where we use lots of telescopes to simulate one telescope. Yeah, I did put this word up at the end of the last lecture. So you know that for optical telescopes, the resolution is limited by the ocean of air that we are under. And so the best we can do is to get as much above the ocean of air as we can. Right? So we put our telescopes on mountaintops. Or in the case of Hubble Space Telescope, above 100% of the atmosphere. If we eliminate the ocean of air as being the problem, then the limiting feature, we're still not going to get perfect images from the Hubble Space Telescope. The limiting feature turns out to be in the nature of the wave that's doing the collecting. And it turns out you can show that the angular resolution that you can just barely resolve is approximately equal to the wavelength of light you're talking about divided by the aperture. So the bigger the aperture, the better the angular resolution you're going to have if we've eliminated the atmosphere, if we're above the Earth's atmosphere. Or if you're really small. So you may notice that just using your own eye, you can't see, you know, the flag on the moon that's left over from Apollo 12, right? You don't have the necessary angular resolution in order to do that. But if you had a bigger aperture, like with binoculars, you can actually see more detail in addition to the magnification that occurs. So for small enough objects, any telescope that's smaller than about that in aperture, The same formula would apply for the limiting feature for the angular resolution. So the problem with a radio telescope is that the wavelength, you know, wavelengths of radio waves are about a meter, whereas for optical light it's about a millionth of a meter. So the wavelengths of light we're talking about are a million times bigger for a radio telescope than for an optical telescope. And the aperture is bigger too, right? 100 meters versus 10 meters, but it's only a factor of 10 bigger. So it turns out the atmosphere isn't a problem for radio light the way it is a problem for visible light. But we've made the wavelength a million times bigger and we've only made the aperture 10 times bigger. So the resolution is going to be worse for a radio antenna than it's going to be for even the biggest optical telescope. So what to do? Well, you can make, like Arecibo, you can make a very big aperture, but you can't make an aperture that's a million times the size of the Keck telescope, right? That would be an aperture that's the same size as the Earth. And it turns out that you don't actually need all of the aperture filled. So instead of having one big telescope, you know, the size of Minnesota, you could have just lots of individual telescopes that, while they don't fill the aperture, have a large enough diameter that they simulate the aperture. So you're not going to collect as much light as you would with the telescope the size of Minnesota, but you will have the angular resolution of the telescope that's the size of Minnesota. So that's exactly the plan with the Very Large Array. We have it's not the size of Minnesota, but it's more about the size of a county, about 35 kilometers in diameter. Those radio telescopes are all on railroad tracks, so they can be moved around into compact versions and larger versions. And we can get then pretty good angular resolution. In fact, we can get better angular resolution than with the Very Large Array than you could get with the Keck telescope that has to look through the ocean of air. Okay, so a radio interferometer or any interferometer is a combination of lots of individual telescopes simulating a big diameter telescope, the purpose being to get better angular resolution. And it turns out that this is hard to do with optical telescopes, but they are trying to do it with optical telescopes too. There's an experiment that's going on Mount Palomar to make an optical interferometer. But in terms of actually operating systems, radio interferometers are pretty common these days. And of course, you know, why call it quits there? Right? So the Very Large Array, Scirocco, New Mexico, is someplace around there. There's a telescope that's in Iowa, there's a telescope that's in Maine, there's a telescope that's in Hawaii. There are telescopes that are sprinkled around the Earth so that you can make a simulated telescope that really does have a size that's comparable to the Earth. So that's called the Very Long Baseline Array, a combination of lots of telescopes separated by thousands of kilometers that simulates a very big telescope and hence has very good angular resolution. Okay. So in terms of observing from ground, radio and visible are kind of the full list. The ozone layer absorbs lots of the ultraviolet light. Some infrared light gets through, but not a lot of it. So if we want to observe the other colors of light, we pretty much have to go above the Earth's atmosphere. So there are big satellites in space that observe infrared and ultraviolet and X-rays and gamma rays so that we can observe these, the colors of light that to which our atmosphere is opaque. And it turns out that a lot of the problem is often the water vapor. So just getting above a lot of the water vapor helps a lot. So there's a new millimeter array that's been set up in the high dry mountains of Chile. But generally speaking, space is great. Of course, it's hard to get there. It's expensive to fix things once they're up there. So ground-based is also not at all bad. And of course, you're always limited by what sort of aperture you can have for a space-based telescope, right? It used to have to fit in the shuttle bay. It still has to fit on some sort of rocket. So it's limited to a diameter of, you know, roughly 2 meters. Whereas current technology, ground-based telescopes are 10 meters in diameter.
Wasn't there a new telescope that was recently launched into the atmosphere to replace the Hubble telescope?
So nothing has replaced the Hubble Space Telescope yet, and kind of the bad news is that Congress actually canceled the funding for the Webb Telescope, which was supposed to be the successor to the Hubble. But I think that that's been reinstituted recently. I can't think of any. So there are always new telescopes going up in space, but I can't think of anything that's big and new that's gone up recently. More questions? Okay, so the last topic on telescopes I want to talk about is the mount. And it may sound like kind of a detail, but it turns out that the ability to point your telescope in any old direction costs about as much as building the telescope itself. So the mounting of a telescope is pretty important. And that's true even at the observatory. The mounts for those telescopes cost just about as much as the telescopes do. And the cameras that we use on those telescopes cost about as much as the telescopes or mounts individually. So there are kind of two common ways of mounting telescopes. The cheapest and the most expensive telescopes use what's called an alt-ASI mount. And that's kind of the most obvious way of arranging your holding. You make one joint that points at zenith, and you have another joint that allows you to change the altitude, and obviously you can then point this telescope at any direction in the sky. The problem is that if you think about tracking a star as it rises in the east and sets in the west, all of those joints have to move in a complicated fashion to keep the telescope aimed at the same point. So in the cheapest version of alt-ASI mounts, you are the computer, right? You constantly change those joints so they're pointing at the star. Whereas in the most expensive versions of alt-ASI joints, you have a computer that's controlling all of these joints so that you can point at the same direction. Okay, so like the Keck telescope has an alt-ASI mount, the Palomar telescope predates computers, so it has the other sort of mount we're gonna talk about, an equatorial mount. And all of the telescopes at the observatory have an equatorial mount. And here the game is, surprisingly simple. And that is, instead of having this joint point at zenith, have it point at the north celestial pole. Because then this joint here will turn at one rate, at one revolution per day, and it'll exactly follow the rotation of the celestial sphere. This joint here just needs to point with a fixed declination because the star's declination is, of course, fixed during the day. So we have one joint that turns at one revolution per day and the other joint is fixed for any particular star, and you can constantly track the stars those ways. So here's a kind of a bigger example of an equatorial mount. Here's the motor that does the driving, and this joint would be pointed at the north celestial pole, and the whole telescope would then turn at the same rate that the sky is turning. Okay, so it's pretty easy. It just takes a one revolution per day motor and a couple of joints. So it's kind of the intermediate cost possibility for mounting a telescope. Okay, question?
What's the value of observing a star for an entire day?
Well, typically, you can't observe a star for an entire day, but you want to observe, if you're looking at a dim object, you want as long a possible time exposure as you can get.
Oh, and so, over time
yeah, every time, the longer you have the shutter open, the more light you're collecting. And so you can collect maybe photons at the rate of one per hour, and you can still get an image of your star. So the longest exposures that have been made by Hubble, and they had like month-long exposures, where Hubble just stared at the same spot in space for a month, and they could see the dimmest objects that are possible. The other reason for being able to track a star for periods of hours is that some stars were learned vary. They get bigger and smaller. And so if you want to monitor those stars and see that they're getting bigger and smaller and brighter and dimmer, then you need to be able to track them for a period of time. Now the longest exposures I've made at our observatory are like 5 minutes long. But my colleague will make a series of 5-minute exposures throughout a night to follow the changing brightness of stars. Questions? Okay, so what I'd like to do is do our last kind of hands-on program. So I've got a bunch of lenses, and I've got a project to do, so it's the usual story of getting into groups of three and doing one of these projects. I know that you're usually the center of one of these groups. There should be, but I see that this one actually fell apart. There should be two lenses in each one of these envelopes I give you, so if there isn't, complain. Is this kind of two groups of three eventually? Yeah, you can just grab one of those envelopes. It's okay if it's broken. So it's maybe a surprising feature that you can take a lens and totally break it apart, and it'll work just as good as it would if they were separate. The only thing you have to be a little bit careful of is getting cuts from the edges. So this project starts out with a bunch of equations. So the first one is the resolution equation that we just talked about, that the resolution is proportional to the wavelength divided by the diameter. We have the definition of the angular size of something. So one of these light bulbs, it's about a meter long. We can figure out what angular size it seems to be by putting in the object size and dividing it by the distance. We've got the F number definition, focal length divided by aperture. And the magnification definition all down there. So you can use the rulers that are the edge of this piece of paper. If you prefer, you can also use one of the ruler rulers. Yeah, I think you want to use centimeters. It's going to be a lot harder to do things in inches, believe it or not.